Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
We're about to sneak up on old Grandfather Winter, and we're going to push him right in the well, aren't we? You feel it? You feel this 80-degree heat coming from outside, and you just see Grandfather Winter. He's looking in the well because he dropped something down in it.
Is he Whitlin?
He is Whitlin, which is why he dropped his favorite Whitlin knife that he got from his Grandfather Winter. So anyway, we're going to sneak up on him. We're going to push him right down in the well. And that's where he's going to live and die, because it's springtime, baby.
And who does he usher in for the spring?
Baby Spring. Baby Spring. Baby Spring has green hair and a leaf hat and diaper and flower shirt and grass shoes and bees. And he's spring, and you get excited to see him because it means Grandfather Winter has died in the well because of us.
Does Baby Spring grow up over the course of a year and become Grandfather Winter?
Well,
and then he is reborn in the spring months.
And I hate to say this, but once Cool Guy Summer gets in, Baby Spring is going wellward.
Ooh, okay.
But the baby, he's fine in there. He's got a whole little, we got a playroom set up down there. And then pretty soon, Cool Guy Summer is going to be down there too. He'll keep him comfortable. Mm-hmm. Really, the only one that doesn't survive the fall is Grandpa Winter.
Okay. So that seems fair.
Looking forward to that. And I'm looking forward to doing this show where we talk about things that we're really excited about, things that we really love, things we're really into. Do you have any of those small wonders that I crave?
Can you go first?
Oh, shoot. I usually use the small wonder time that you put forward to consider and think about my own small wonder. I mean, mine are all going to be pretty nerdy. If it like gun to my head, there's some new content for Fire Emblem Three Houses on the Switch. That is good stuff.
Fire Emblem Three Houses?
Emblem.
Emblem
Three. Emblem's not a word. And you should know that.
Now, let me tell you what I'm picturing with that. I am picturing a Property Brothers style video game in which you build a house for a young couple.
Oh.
And these new updates you just got are new Fire Emblems.
A third Property Brother. There is a third Property
there
Brother,
is,
actually.
Yeah, a fourth.
Oh, my God, really?
A fifth?
Who knows? That's what the DLC is. Mm-hmm. No, it's an anime-ass strategy game, and there's new stuff out, and it's really hard. And it's like, I like a good strategy game that feels kind of chessy. Like, it feels like doing chess puzzles. Mm-hmm. I don't really go for a lot of strategy games, so like it really takes a lot to get me there. And yeah, it's a good one. You can play it on the go. I like it. Do you have, now you've certainly got a dope
small wonder. Yeah, Griffin made a really good short rib meal.
Oh my.
On Friday.
I did.
There was some Dutch oven work. There was some short rib tomato sauce.
A little ragu on a, mixing with a little gnocchi.
Gnocchi.
Mm-hmm. I rarely like to toot my own horn. But it's the fucking most ballin' thing I've ever cooked by a pretty wide margin.
Yeah, I think it's my favorite. It's my new fave.
Yeah, that Dutch oven. Wow. It can get shit done, man.
It gets real hot in there.
It gets really hot in there. And on the lid, which I may have touched, forgetting that lids are also in the oven and they do get hot. You go first this week.
Oh, great.
What do you set the tone for us? Why don't you?
My first thing
is
the hero's journey.
All right.
Yeah.
Is it sad I only know about this because of Brian David Gilbert?
A little bit.
Okay. Didn't really learn about it in school. I learned about it from I forget what episode that was about. I think the Zelda games, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I learned about it in creative writing class when I was an undergraduate in college. I think I was a junior in college, and it was my intermediate level creative writing short fiction class. Mm. And the graduate instructor came in and said, "Do you guys know about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey?" And maybe some people said yes, but I did not.
Yeah.
And blew my mind. It just like unpacks and like provides a key to so many films and books in history.
All of them, more or less.
More or less all of them.
Mentoring Brian David Gilbert made me think of my small wonder, which is Pat Gill's interview of
Ben Schwartz
about the Sonic movie that had me busting the fuck up. It is so funny.
Good.
If you haven't watched it yet, it's a Polygon video where Pat Gill interviews him and gives him 10 seconds to answer questions. It's so funny. It's so good. Okay, sorry.
Okay, so I didn't and still don't know a lot about Joseph Campbell. A lot of people are familiar with The Power of Myth, which is a book based on a 1988 PBS documentary all about Joseph Campbell.
Okay.
Joseph Campbell was a professor of literature at Sarah Lawrence who worked a lot in mythology and religion. So he's kind of a pivotal figure in a lot of literary like examination and criticism. He put together The Hero with a Thousand Faces in 1949, which talks all about the classic story structure.
Okay.
This story structure went on to inform Star Wars, just fundamentally Star Wars, but then also The Matrix, Indiana Jones, The Lion King. And it follows this 17-stage structure that you find on almost every like hero's journey story.
Any film with a hero in it who does journey in some regard.
I was hoping kind of that you could think of a like a hero's quest kind of movie, and then you the one that you have to know pretty well, and then when you could kind of help me identify.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Could be like a Ferris Bueller. It could be like a Labyrinth. It could be like a Goonies.
Right. I'm just trying to think of one that I maybe Groundhog Day.
Okay.
Do you think that would fit the structure? Okay.
Sure. Okay. First call to adventure.
Yeah, I mean, he has to go to Punxsutawney for work.
Refusal of the call.
He does not want to go to Punxsutawney for work because it's cold and miserable there.
Who is his supernatural aide?
I mean, you don't really see it, right? You don't really see the entity that grants him his powers.
Yeah.
So it is there, but not explicitly like given a face.
This, for example, in Star Wars would be like a Yoda.
Oh, yeah.
For example.
Yeah. Or just the Force. In general, I don't know. We could get really metaphysical get about it if you want.
And then there's the moment where this is the fourth stage, crosses the threshold,
I mean,
which is the point where the hero crosses into the adventure.
Yeah, I mean, he enters Punxsutawney and can't leave. There's like a scene where he like drives through the blockade and goes into town and he can't get out.
That's a good point. Okay, belly of the whale.
I mean, arguably, like when he's in there the morning of Groundhog Day doing the work begrudgingly, that's belly.
Okay, so now we have exited the Departure Act. We are now in initiation.
Okay.
For stage six, the Road of Trials. Now, this is most of the movie.
This is a majority of the film where he enjoys his powers and then things get very, very morose.
Okay, then what is formerly called the meeting with the goddess, but this is when
Andy fucking McDowell.
This is when the hero faces temptations, often physical or pleasurable, that may lead him to abandon his quest. Andy McDowell.
Well, no, before Andy McDowell there's a bunch of women that he like messes around with and like proposes to one of them, knowing that it's just going to disappear the next morning. Yeah,
this reminds me of Lost in Translation when he meets the lounge singer.
Yeah, there's a lot of, maybe art imitating life.
And then this is followed similarly by the temptress. So there's the meeting and then there's the actual act of temptation.
Right.
Now, atonement with the father. This is when the hero must confront and be initiated with whatever holds the ultimate power in his life.
Wow. That's tough. I mean, his own ego, I guess, arguably. He has to learn to kind of shed that a little bit before he can make any progress.
This leads to apotheosis, which is where a greater understanding is achieved.
Yeah.
So this may be the
moment.
Comes
in waves.
Yeah, where he becomes kind of fatalistic.
Yeah, and it comes in waves, his realization of like what he needs to be to actually be happy.
Then the ultimate boon, which is the achievement of the goal or the quest.
Andy McDowell. They fall in love.
Okay. Okay, now we are on return, which is the final few stages. We're on stage 12 now.
Right.
Refusal of the return. The hero may not want to return to the ordinary world.
I don't know that we get that.
This is where it gets tricky. So the return is kind of where a lot of movies like hop out.
Right, because at that point, like they've given you the climax. They can't spend unless it's Lord of the Rings, like they can't spend another hour exploring the aftermath.
Yeah, I was thinking of Labyrinth in this case, where Sarah gets back to the bedroom and like she suddenly misses all of her friends, you know, and then she sees him in the mirror.
Right. There's probably some of this in Groundhog Day where like on his way out, like a cop stops him and he's like, fuck off, cop. And he's like, oops, wait, this is permanent now. I don't have the time travel anymore.
The magic flight is the next stage. This is where he must escape with the boon if it is something that the gods were guarding.
Well, so the cops are now after him and Andy McDowell. They're on the run. They're in love.
Rewrite.
But he punched Ned Brierson. Shit, I can't remember his name.
Brierson.
That sounds right.
Mm-hmm. Rescue from without.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. This is when the hero must have guides and rescuers bring him back to everyday life.
This is Christopher. Oh shit! What's the dude's name in Groundhog Day from
Chris Elliott.
Christopher Elliott is sort of his.
Some
guide.
Of us are more familiar, I guess.
Yeah.
Final three stages: the crossing of the return threshold.
He smashes through the police barricade.
This is where he must retain the wisdom to integrate it in life and figure out how to share it with the world.
Okay, that is kind of like the last, you know, act of the movie when he's going through like the repeats and just trying to like not perform about it, but just kind of be good.
Mm-hmm. Which then becomes master of two worlds, which is where the hero is comfortable and competent in the inner and outer world.
He's a time walker, and that's a whole thing that we can get into later.
And then final stage, freedom to live. The mastery leads to freedom from the fear of death, which in turn is the freedom to live.
Whoa, okay. Mm-hmm. He probably got there. He died like 1,000 times.
There you go. Those are the 17 stages. I think this is like an incredible outline for anybody who wants to write like an epic story.
Yeah.
Like I remember hearing this in my like short fiction class thinking, oh, this is it right here. If I were to write a novel, I would just say, okay, the first, you know, 20 pages call to adventure, next 30 pages refusal of the call. You know, it just like sets the whole structure for you.
Long ass book, hon.
Well,
that's going to be like a what? Like a 240-page book at that point.
I'm writing the new Lord of the Rings.
Oh, boy.
But it's called Lady of the Bracelets.
All right, Lady of the Bracelets. Okay, so we got a bunch of bracelets. Some were given to...
Keep in mind, I don't know anything about Lord of the Rings. Continue.
Well, then maybe you should tell me what it's about.
Okay, so...
Basing it on your knowledge of Lord of the Rings.
Okay, so there are a bunch of really... big people.
Okay.
I'm doing
so opposite of hobbits is what you're going with. Mm-hmm. What are those called now?
Large bits.
Large bits is great. Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that.
Uh-huh. And they live in the wire.
Oh, so it's like they live in Baltimore then?
Yes.
That's fun.
And there's one that's like the most special one.
Mm. Omar from The Wire.
He's called to go on a quest to find the bracelet that will save his people.
Okay.
And there's...
What happens when he puts the bracelet on? Tell me that.
He is overcome with the power.
Okay.
And maybe he'll do bad things he's not strong enough.
You know
to
more
wear
about
the
Lord of the Rings than I think you're
And there's like
on.
A little guy that guards the bracelet.
And his name is...
Oh, we do this all the time.
Oh,
I
you
feel
love
like
it,
Gollum.
You? Yeah, but but that's not what it's called in Lady of the Bracelets.
No.
In Lady of the Bracelets, he's named.
She
is named.
Is named Slalom.
Oh.
Very good skier.
Okay, that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
This bit is accessible. And it's definitely not like a Mad magazine from like 1971. It's fucking great.
Thank you.
Can I do my first thing?
Yes.
It's going to be really quick because it's more of a concept.
Okay.
It's sort of a broad idea, if you will. Secret doors. Secret doors. Hidden doors. Doors that are hidden in some way and allow access to secret areas and things.
Mm, like you pull a book off a bookcase and then
that's sort of the ideal, right? Like that's what you think of when you say, hey, I got a secret door in my house. You think you got a bookshelf where you pull on one of the books and it opens up a thing. I think I've only seen that in themed restaurants. Like, I'm pretty sure they have that shit at like Magic Castle in LA, which they might get insulted if I call it a theme restaurant, but let's be fucking honest, guys. Like, you're a bunch of magicians doing things. Anyway, and like the Jekyll and Hyde Club in New York City, I remember had to, like, one of those you had to do before you could go to the bathroom. But like, I don't think I've ever actually been to a house where that is a thing. But I like the idea of it very much. At the old Polygon offices, actually, there was a bookshelf that had a book that had to be in a certain place, and it would open up the bookshelf into what was essentially our gaming room where we would capture game footage. And by virtue of the fact that the door was a huge ass bookshelf and there was no other entry into the room, it got so hot in there. It got so, so, so hot in there, but it was worth it because it had a cool book door, book key, and I like that a lot. There's, I think I've talked about Richard Garriott on this show before. Yeah. I feel like I've talked about him a lot because he's an Austinite and he's like a fascinating dude because he was a game developer who made this seminal RPG series called Ultima and basically used it to bankroll his own private sort of space adventure. But he owns a house here in Austin that is full of like an entire network of secret doors.
And yeah, we saw a video that kind of showcased some of the exciting elements of that house.
It's wild. Yeah, there's like some skulls on a table that have to be in like a particular arrangement to open up a spiral staircase in his wine like rack that goes down. And then there's a mirror next to a bookshelf where you have to reach up into the ceiling and let go of a latch and the mirror pushes inward and opens up to a new staircase. Like, it is literally, it is designed. And then behind that staircase is a room with a fucking Sputnik in it for some reason, because my man is like
space enthusiast.
He's a space enthusiast. It is wild. You can find videos of it. But there is also, and I learned this today, a pretty wide like category of YouTube videos of what I would call home improvement dads with too much time on their hands building secret doors in bookcases and or wardrobes and or whatever the fuck.
I like this. You know, I was one of those kids that got real into Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yes.
And like spent a good part of my childhood just looking for those secret passages into Narnia.
Mm-hmm. And there is no shortage of videos of like, you know, goobers actually making it happen in a way that makes it seem so accessible. Like, oh, I could do that. We would have to convert one of our rooms into the secret room, and it feels like you're diminishing the square footage of your house somewhat. Yeah. Like maybe just a closet, like a small closet.
Or we could take some of our larger closets and put another closet in the closet.
That's fucking great. That's very good.
You think you've reached the back of the closet? Oh no,
there's more.
More closet.
I don't know that we own anything that I would worry about enough to hide inside of the closet panic room. aside from, I guess, ourselves and our child. So that's, again, sort of a broad category, but what I also like are just like knowing the secret sort of doors and routes in buildings that not everybody knows all about. So like when I think about secret doors, what I think about is there was in the journalism school at Marshall, this like hatch on the floor outside of my advisor's office. And it was just like an access hatch to this wind tunnel that like went under the J school over to the old library. And you could like exit out onto the street over there, but it was like really well hidden and it took a lot of effort to pry it out. But once you did, it like created this wild windstorm in the journalism school that would knock the ceiling tiles out of place. So it was like this, you were channeling the elements.
That's so cool. I always get jealous. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to live in a harsh climate, but those areas of the country that have real severe winter and they have those underground tunnels.
Yeah. I mean, Huntington has a lot of like tunnels that aren't necessarily like a completely interconnected network, but it's an old town and there are, I don't know, I feel like an abundance of, you saw some of it in the Mabim Bam TV show. We shot in some of them under the Keith Albee that just has like endless cavern of storage space that like sprawls beneath like a significant portion of you know, the street that it's on. And I think that's really neat. I think just knowing the secrets of a place is such a like rewarding feeling, even though like if we had a secret room in this house, like it would be more of an annoyance. Like if there was a secret door into a bookshelf into my office, I feel like I would just like, oh, you know, I'm carrying my coffee and my soup. I can't pull down my magic book. I think about that.
Or if you were like, you know, it's nighttime and you like can't see where the book is that you have to pull down. Mm-hmm.
But I think I just like the idea of like secret spaces. I think there's something very seductive about that and about it being kind of a showpiece, like in your house, if you did have it. Like it would be the thing that maybe you showed people, maybe you didn't. Maybe that's how you make people feel like actually welcome in the house, is like, hey, I'm letting you in on the big secret. This is where our sex room is. That is probably what they might think at first blush.
Would you be prepared to bring a contractor in and have that conversation that is like, I know there's a door here. I want you to get rid of the door and make it look like there was never a door here, but maintain the integrity of the room behind the door?
I would say two things. One, we live in a pretty whimsical city, so I'd be surprised if they would be completely blown away by that request.
Oh, another one of those secret rooms. All right, I got it.
We could also just get Garrett's guy and just like, so like, what do you got in there? Some fucking Tesla coils? Like, no, it's my office. Don't worry about it.
It's a shoe closet. It's going to continue to be a shoe closet, but we're going to make it look like not a shoe closet. Go for it.
Go nuts. Hey, can I steal you away?
Yes.
We have a couple of Jumbotrons.
Can I read the first one?
Wow, yes. Oh, I see why you want to read this one.
Yes. This message is for Beth. It is from Lex. Hey, Beth. This is just to say, I have bought the Jumbotron on this show with our faves, and which you are probably not expecting to receive. Forgive me. You are wonderful, so kind, and so loving. Thank you for 6 years together. Love, Lex.
That is very nice.
Oh, what a treat for me, the reader.
You know my favorite part of that poem? Nobody stole any fucking fruit.
That's true. Everybody got out with all their original fruit.
And I like that. Everybody celebrates that other poem, and it's like, they're a fucking thief. We're celebrating fruit crimes. Mm-hmm. Here's a message for Nova, and it's from Vic, who says, just a quick shout out to the love of my life. I'm so incredibly proud of you, and I can't wait until we get to spend the rest of our lives together in a small suburban town in Wisconsin. Until then, syncing Netflix and multiple four-hour phone calls will have to suffice. I love you so much, mi amor. Or perhaps my armor? No. I love that. It's like, hey, babe, you're my armor. No. You protect me from the slings and arrows of this world.
No.
You provide me with a thick, steely exterior.
That's not what
a powerful thank you for being my powerful steel exoskeleton.
No.
My mech that I climb inside to fight off the angels.
Hey, everyone. It's I, John Hodgman of the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
And I, Elliot Kalin of the Flophouse podcast.
And we've made a whole new podcast, a 12-episode special mini-series called iPodius, in which we recap, discuss, and explore the very famous 1976 BBC miniseries about ancient Rome called I, Claudius. We've got incredible guests such as Gillian Jacobs, Paul F. Tompkins, as well as star of I, Claudius, Sir Patrick Stewart, and his son, non-Sir Daniel Stewart.
Don't worry, Dan, you'll get there someday.
iPodius is the name of the show. Every week from MaximumFun.org for only 12 weeks. Get them at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Can I tell you my next thing?
Yes.
This one not quite as epic as the hero's journey. I'm talking about the humble but effective fingernail clipper.
Oh, yeah. I love this guy. I got one of these guys. Look at this guy. Here's where the rubber ones went. I know you're looking for the rubber ones. They're up here.
Griffin always has fingernail clippers in the strangest parts of the house.
I grow nails very quickly.
Now, are they mostly on your fingers and toes, or would I find them in other places on your body?
I'm not going to let you know where my nails are, babe.
You'll never tell.
I'm not going to tell the audience, but you know exactly where I grow my nails.
He's got eye nails.
That's true.
It's difficult because he has these long, beautiful lashes, which I would never want him to trim, but the eye nails
make me
uncomfortable.
You can't have one without the other, babe. The reason those eyelashes grow so thick and lustrous is because it's also got nails.
Do you want to hear about the nail clipper?
Yeah, sure.
Around 1875, patents for the modern nail clipper began to appear.
We were biting them before this, huh?
You know, there are a surprising number of articles on the internet of people positing what clipped nails before the nail clipper.
And there's no consensus on this?
Some of it is like, well, you know how dogs wear them down on the concrete? People probably did that.
Huh. I guess at what age, in what era did we start to give a shit about our nails? Mm-hmm.
And also people suggested, you know, just ways of filing the nail.
Oh, yeah. That was
And then, of course, you know, like just knives, scissors.
Yeah.
You know.
Sucks. God, that sucks.
I got to tell you about the person who did the first patent for a nail trimmer named Valentine Fogarty.
Holy shit.
That's so great.
Yeah.
This was a circular nail file. So not exactly like the clipper we know today. The first patent for the clamp style fingernail clipper was 1881.
Okay.
We are used to the compound lever clipper. There's also a plier clipper.
What is that? Oh, like instead of it having the resistance, you just it's literally just like a pair of scissors then kind of
It looks like a plier. Like it's the kind you would like clip like a dog's nail.
Yeah, that with. Sucks. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's rough. Mm-hmm. Jeez, this one's skeezing me out a little bit, babe.
Now, let me tell you a little bit about the thing that changed everything. Didn't happen until 1947. There are people alive today that didn't have access to this clipper.
Okay.
It's the one that has the jaw style design, but it has the little nibs near the base to prevent lateral movement.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
You know the little nibs?
I love those guys. Uh-huh.
And then there's a notched rivet, which adds the thumb swerve to the lever.
Oh, yeah. And mm-hmm. I'm just doing that right now. See, you see me over here messing with the thumb swerve, and I'm just kind of spinning the top of the jaw all the way around. And at this point, it's not just a grooming tool, babe. It's a toy. I'm having fun with it.
The original fidget spinner.
Hey, hon, why'd you decide to talk about this?
It is such a perfect little tool.
It's good at what it does.
I mean, a lever is a satisfying tool no matter what.
Yes, that's a good point.
But I just think about just like the general size and shape. Now, some would argue that the size and shape is not exactly the size of a fingernail.
Oh.
You know, you have to go around one side and then the other and then the middle.
Yeah.
You know? But I just like, I find the process of clipping fingernails like so precise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of the perfect tool to do it.
You say perfect, but that is selling our imaginations short. So I guess.
Here's the thing.
How can we improve them?
Okay, so there have been improvements.
Oh my God.
There's like just a general, like a fatter clamp. You know, so you get more like
that's just
work on it. There's also a side model. So instead of like coming like this way, you can hold it sideways.
I like that actually.
So your right or left hand, it doesn't matter. Because the argument is that your stronger hand is going to be the more precise hand.
Okay.
And so people say if you use it like from the side with like a side handle,
then
it doesn't matter as much with your dominant hand. Okay. I also, this is the fun design, is the one that has like the real long pole so that if you can't reach your toes.
I was just about to say.
Mm-hmm, that's a real thing.
What about just sort of an automated sort of mulcher that you could kind
of very... Oh, you just put your whole hand in?
Well, I was thinking feet. I can do my fingernails. Well, I can do my left hand. So my left hand nails look like professionally mm-hmm. done, and my right hand nails always look like a child has tried to do them with like a pencil sharpener or something like that. My toes, like, forget about it. I need the mulcher.
So you would want to put your toes into a machine.
Yeah.
That doesn't terrify you at all?
Well, the machine's going to be custom made for my feet.
Oh, that's nice.
And all of a sudden, this does sound like a product that we would sponsor on this.
This is something we could put in our secret room, though, ultimately, which
yeah,
I like.
But then it's not going to, like, people are going to see that and not instantly think it's not a sex dungeon. Can I talk about my second thing?
Yes, please.
My second thing is a song, and it is a powerful theme, an anthem that will get you just ready to go. And that song is Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drells. I love when I sent you this song just to make sure that you had heard it before. The way that you first found it was through The Simpsons.
Yeah, it was interesting because I said there's like a Simpsons bit where it's like Homer, it's like a flashback, and he's like performing this song as a one-man band. And I remember thinking like, huh, that's funny. And then years later when I heard the song, I was
right.
like, oh, that's an actual song.
I heard it for the first time, you know, when I was a child, probably when I was about like 20. I heard it on You Look Nice Today. There's an episode where they talked about Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drells, and now, like today, it pops up constantly on like the four or five different playlists that I have it on. And the reason I have it so widespread is because it is a perfect song. It is so straightforward and good and pure. And I just almost always am in the mood to hear it. And that's not true for a lot of songs. Like, it's never come up and I've been like, ugh, I'm not, I don't have time for you right now, Archie Bell and the Drells is Tighten Up. It's always like, oh, hell yeah, here it is. It's time
what?
To go.
And now what is the, normally people would hear the phrase tighten up and they would think that that is not a thing somebody wants to do. Do you have a sense of what tighten up means? In this
Maybe you don't want to tighten up, but Archie Bell is just so sort of like enthusiastically telling everyone on earth, one person at a time. He actually, if you listen to the whole song, names every single person.
Fun.
Yeah. So he's like, Rachel McElroy, tighten up. And he gives it to everybody. And so everybody tightens it up. If you've never heard this song, it is just like, it is this early kind of like foundational funk hit that came out in, I believe, 1968. And it is, it sort of like, it topped the R&B and pop Billboard charts and was really the first sort of funk song to achieve that level of popularity. So yeah, if you've never heard it, I'm going to play just the beginning of the song. It's so good. So powerful and so strong. So here's the beginning of Tighten Up.
First, tighten up on the drum. Come on now, drummer. I want you to tighten it up for me now. Oh, yeah. Tighten up on that bass now. Tighten it up. Yeah. Now let that guitar fall in. Oh, yeah.
At the beginning there, he says a lot of great shit, including, we don't only sing, but we dance just as good as we want. And I'm not entirely sure what that means, but I'm glad that he feels empowered to dance just as good as he wants. He also starts out by saying that they're from, they're Archie Bell and the Drells, they're from Houston, Texas. And the reason he said that, apparently, is because, and this was in an interview with some magazine, it was after the Kennedy assassinations, and he had heard a comment that nothing good ever comes out of Texas.
Oh.
So he wanted to, he has a quote where he said he wanted people to know that we were from Texas and we were good. the song is just like, you heard that clip and there's, you know, obviously a lot more to the song and it's all very good, but like you kind of get the structure if you hear the first 30 seconds of it, where it's Archie Bell just sort of enthusiastically encouraging all of his bandmates to tighten it up and play incredible fills. The bass runs on this song, the licks are so fucking hot. And then the break beats, like the drum breaks are like so incredible. And I feel like they are inspirational to a lot of like the funk music that came after. Honestly, there are lots of different genres where I feel like you could hear that, those exact sort of beats it happening inside of them. Like it
is
such a fresh song.
I feel like it's the kind of song that like if you and I were at a party and this song came on, we would instantly feel like the party was cooler.
Yes, absolutely. I would feel welcome. It is a comforting song for me. The origins of the song are kind of wild, right? So Archie Bell and the Drells is the band that put it out and popularized it. Archie Bell, the origins are kind of complicated. Archie Bell, from Houston, Texas, big family. He had like six or seven brothers or sisters. And he got drafted to serve in the army during the Vietnam War. And he was a musician already at this point. He was bummed out. And his bandmate, named Billy Butler, taught him this dance to like cheer him up. That's like how the story goes. Then the dance was called Tighten Up. At the same time, in Houston, there was another R&B group that was called the TSU Tornadoes, and they would like play shows around town, and this was like the riff they would play, that two-chord. They would play that, and it was like that song was like their theme song. They would like play that to like get people pumped. The TSU Tornadoes and Archie Bell and the Drells had the same manager. So he like put them in a room together.
Oh.
Archie Bell had like... took this dance, the TSU Tornadoes like did the background, and then they just like, and apparently it sounds like kind of like loose and improvisational. It took like 30 or 40 takes. Like they were in the studio like all night putting this down. But this manager was sort of the alchemist who brought like all these different components together. This was originally a B-side to another song that they were trying to make like happen, and it just wasn't. And then DJs were like, hey, let's flip this over. Oh shit. And then it just sort of became it became this national hit while Archie Bell was deployed. Archie Bell was Archie Bell was deployed. He was stationed in Germany and he was injured. He like injured his leg. And so, even after he came back, like he couldn't dance. They had choreography and stuff. Like he couldn't really do it. So like while he was recovering, they put out this full length album and they went on to like have a bit more of a career after that. But like this is by far like their biggest hit, and it is just really, really good.
Have you looked to see if there's videos on the YouTube?
There is. They are like pretty low quality, but you can see the dance. The dance is not
really
like
curious.
It is not like, you know, like Jackson 5 level choreography than that. Like it's
Does
a lot
give
more.
Give you a clue as to what tightening up is?
No.
Okay.
But I think it's okay to not know explicitly what
you know, like,
up.
But this is not far from the time frame where everybody was like telling you what the dance was and how to do it. I just wondered if this was like an actual like a dance. People would be at the club and you would be like, oh, that man is.
There was a tighten up dance, okay. Right? But it was not. It was very low impact. Okay. I would say. I would argue. But really, I think this was just like the party starter. Like this was just the song that made you want to just fucking groove because Archie Bell was up there telling you to do it. And then you would hear like just all of these different sort of patchwork, just funky ass like sections of this song. It's just great. It's just perfect. I'm going to like, it's nice to know that I have this constant in my life of just like, here's a song that I will always be excited to hear. Unless I like burn out on it, but yeah, I think it'd be hard to do. I love Tighten Up. Do you want to know what our friends at home are talking about?
Yes, please.
Alex says, my wonder is maritime museums. The Columbia River Maritime Museum has an exhibit called the Lightship Columbia, and it's an actual place you get to walk around, a floating lighthouse. Neat. A lot of maritime museums have floating exhibits like that, and you can see what it was like living aboard as a boatswain. I think I mostly picked this one because it had the word boatswain in it.
Have you ever been in a maritime museum?
No, but
yeah, this is something that people that don't live on the coast don't really get access to.
I'm sure it's very cool though.
I'm open to it for sure.
I've been to aquariums, which is like a fish museum with water in it, if you think about it.
Oh
yeah, and fishes is like boat pets because they live under them.
You are such a poet, Griffin.
Thank you. Nathan says lizards are wonderful. Take Nathan's word for it. That's it.
That's it. Woo.
But it makes you think, doesn't it? It is evocative in a way. Lizards, my relationship with them is we live in Texas, and so I almost always step on them all the time every day.
little guys
just bloop. I guess I like big lizards too.
I like a lizard on a rock, just sunning.
Yeah.
I like that.
Our friend had a big lizard that would eat bugs and stuff, and that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I guess they're eating bugs, and maybe there's a lot of bugs that I'm not a big fan of that they like to eat, and that's good to me, I guess. And some of them have beards, and that's funny, like sideburns and shit. That's cool. But the problem is, King Koopa's a lizard. Ugh, I hate that guy.
Such a childish spirit.
Thank you to Bowen and Augustus for the for theme song Money Won't Pay. You can find a link to that in the episode description. Thank you to Maximum Fun for having us on the network. Max Fun Drive is coming up very soon.
Yeah, we recorded our bonus episode.
It was so good. Rachel
Griffin assures me it was good.
It was very good. Rachel has never talked about video games professionally before, but she played Animal Crossing New Leaf for like 2 weeks. A game that I adore, and I know a lot of our listeners do. And then we talked about this video game for like 45 minutes, and it was a lot of fun. I liked it a lot. We got to play together a little bit, and that made me very happy. I think that's it. We are so proud of you. We're so proud of you. And it's about time that somebody said it. You've been working hard.
You have. You know, and you're loyal.
You're so loyal to a fault. No, you're not that loyal. You're loyal, but not to a fault, you know? You're a good amount of loyal.
Yeah.
And it's because of that that I think it's important we wrap this one up by saying, proud of you.
Proud of you.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Hey, you've reached Dr. Game Show. Leave your message after the beep.
Dr. Game Show is my favorite podcast and the only podcast my parents let me listen to because I'm 12. But even old people love this show. Basically, you call in, play games, and have fun. If you win a game, a baby will send you a magnet in the mail. I have so many magnets and put them all over my locker, and pretty much everyone at school is jealous because they are very cool custom magnets, and it also means that I'm really good at winning games. And they even let me practice my record live on the air. Listening to this show is like going to a real doctor, but pretty much kind of better. Dr. Game Show rocks.
Listen to Dr. Game Show on Maximum Fun. New episodes every other Wednesday.